Yeah, so what we've done so far is for a non-interacting and translation invariant Hamiltonian, we found the eigen energies and the eigenstates. And then just this week, we have used these to compute various things. So in particular, we use E to compute some quantities like the specific heat, the electrical conductivity, and the thermal conductivity. So today we're going to look at something that you cannot get from the energies, and we have to look at the wave functions. So to sort of motivate this topic, I want to bring up sort of an experimental fact. So there's a material called bismuth selenide, which goes by the name of a topological insulator. So today we're not going to get anywhere near really understanding exactly what this is, but we'll understand the main idea of what a topological insulator is. So the reason why it gets this name, at least from the experimental perspective, is you take a cube of this, then inside the cube, the bulk of this material is an insulator, meaning that it has a band gap. So there's some band gap, all the states below the gap are filled, all the states above the gap are empty. Then on the surface, you get something like this. So there's some gapless surface state. So one explanation of this, so everything we talked about so far, we've talked about periodic boundary conditions, which is important because it let us actually solve things, and we didn't need to deal with surfaces because surfaces are difficult and confusing and hard. So one hypothesis might be that this surface state is nothing special, but it's just that surfaces are confusing and there's some complicated Hamiltonian that describes the surface, and it happens to give us this gapless band structure. But that's actually turns out not to be true. So the way we can tell that is if we perturb the system. So for example, cut the surface at a different angle relative to the crystal structure, the gapless states remain. So this is kind of a mysterious thing. There's a very robust feature at the surface, which seems to have nothing to do with what's happening in the bulk. So if you have this kind of robustness, it's a hint to something topological going on. That if topology is kind of the study of what's left once you say the perturbations are not important anymore. So that's exactly what seems to be happening here. Okay, so this is the motivation, but now we're going to step back and talk about some more abstract ideas of topology, and then we'll try to see how it might come into play here. So, I do want to talk about something called homotopy. And by the way, it may be helpful to me, so just to hear, what are all your backgrounds like? Have you taken a class in algebraic geometry or something like this? Or have you heard of homotopy? I have no idea what your backgrounds might be.
I know what it is.
Okay. Okay, so I will not assume that you know these things, but fortunately what we need is not too complicated. So the idea is, I have some kind of space, which is a manifold, we'll call it M1, another one called M2, and I'm going to look at functions which map from M1 to M2. And our goal is to classify these functions. So what I mean by classify is something like this. If I take my function, let's say, for example, is from the interval 0, 1, and it's going to map to the real numbers, let's say. So then my function could look something like this. Here's f of 0. And then as I increase from 0 to 1, my function does something like this. Sorry, I didn't do that. Let's go here. And this is f of 1. Note that in the vertical axis here is like, let's call this parameter x. My vertical axis here is x. I'm just showing you, as I increase x, this is what happens to the value of my function. It goes back and forth. OK, so this is some kind of function. Now, what I want to claim is that we call functions equivalent, topologically equivalent, if I can continuously change this picture from one function to the other one. So an example here would be the following function. So this is equivalent to f, because you could imagine you just sort of like push this in a little bit, you pull that out a little bit, push this in, you pull that out, and then you get this picture. That's a continuous deformation. These functions would be considered equivalent. But we can do even more than that. So another one that's equivalent would be just this. In other words, the constant function is also equivalent. In fact, you can sort of see that any function from 0, 1 to here is going to basically have a start point and an end point, and I can just move them around freely in this space. And actually, all functions from 0, 1 to R are equivalent. OK, so now we can look at something that might be more non-trivial. Non-trivial in the technical sense that this is called the trivial group because there's only one element. So non-trivial in the sense that there may be multiple things that you can go happen that are different. So let's suppose now that I'm going to map from S1 to R, S1 being a circle, and R, of course, being our real numbers again. So it turns out here that everything is going to be equivalent again. So a function here, a function dependent on S1, Notably, because S1 is a periodic space, any function from here to real numbers must be a periodic function. So we require that f of 0 is equal to f of 1 because 0 is here, and we go around, and then 1 is the same point again. So yeah, this will look something like this. But then we do a continuous deformation. And we get this, which is the constant function, and that can be done with any function. So this tells me that, again, maps from S1 to R are all equivalent. So this is actually, this thing gets a name. It goes by the name pi 1 of R is defined maps S1 to R classification. And that's, again, turns out to be the trivial group. OK, so now let's find an example which really is non-trivial. So instead, we're going to look at maps from S1 to S1.
And could you pull down the top board a little?
Yes.
Just a little. Yeah, that's good. Thank you.
Yeah. Great. Okay, so in this case, something interesting happens. So you can imagine I have a map from my initial space to my target space, where as I go around the circle, in this case, I do something like this. So I the first half of the circle, I just go down to the bottom, and the second half of the circle, I go retrace my path. So this is equivalent to a path where I didn't do anything. Like, you could imagine I slowly decrease the amount of distance that I travel. Like, I decrease the speed that I do this traveling along the second circle. And eventually, I find this is just equivalent to the map where I didn't do anything. On the other hand, you could imagine a map where when I go around here, I also go around in this circle. And now, this map is not the same as the constant map, because basically I would have to, when I go back here, when I get to the end, I reattach my string, let's say, and I would have to break that string in order to recreate this picture. So this is not equivalent. Another thing that's not equivalent would be something like this. So we go around twice. And we can do the same, continuing the same thing. So our conclusion is that maps are characterized by an integer, which we call the winding number, which is the number of times that we go around the target space. any perturbation I make to the maps, to a particular map, will preserve this winding number. Therefore, this is a topological invariant. So we write this in the following way, that pi 1 of S1 is equal to the integers. OK, so now I want to see how we can actually use this. So we're going to go back to talking about our physics problem at this point. So why are maps from S1 useful to us? Answer is because in 1D, the space of momenta is periodic from 0 to 2 pi. And that exactly is the circle. That's exactly our S1 space. So then if we look at, let's look at E of k. This is, in fact, a map from S1 to R, because E is a real number. So as we've just established, nothing topological can happen just by looking at E, because we said that the classification of maps is that all maps are equivalent. OK, but how about the wave function? So here, it does seem that maybe something more interesting could happen. So we're going to map from k to some eigenstate ck dagger 0. So here there's something which I think is confusing. And I'm not going to be able to explain it super well, actually. But basically, this ck dagger doesn't really have a well-defined geometry exactly, because these are orthogonal vectors that form a vector space, as opposed to being like a clear geometric space that we could easily identify. So this is not really the map that we want. What we actually want is do you want to define a wave function psi of k which is the vector of coefficients of the ck dagger 0 basis states for each k. So OK, this case is a bit confusing what this means, because we only have one ck dagger for each k. So as you may suspect, nothing interesting is going to happen in this particular case. So in this case, psi of k is just equal to some, could be equal to some phase, because we can always put a phase on our wave function. It doesn't change anything physically. So
I was thinking this was going to be like an n-dimensional vector, like for each game.
In principle, it can be, yes. So we'll see that in a minute. So yeah, for what right now, what I want to do is I'm gonna suppose we just have one CK dagger per each K, and our wave function looks like this e to the I 5 K. So this actually is the space S1, because e to the I 5 K just describes the unit circle in complex space, right? So indeed, then the map K to phi of K is an S1 to S1 map. And so we could try to classify it. So what can happen? Since phi has to be periodic, we could have something that looks like this, where phi increases from 0 to 2 pi. Or we could have something that looks like this, and it just goes back to 0. These are both allowed periodic functions because they end at somewhere where e to the I 2 pi equals 1. OK, so how do we distinguish these two cases? Like, suppose I have the function. Suppose I'm given a function phi of k. How do I know which case I'm in? Just from looking at these pictures, how would you? I'm given some complicated function phi of k, and I'm asked my question is, I'm asked which of these pictures is it that it's going to go around the circle or not around the circle? Yeah, but maybe I can manage phases differently.
Will one have a winding number of 1 and one have a winding number of 0?
Yeah, but that's right. But the question is, how do I calculate the winding number given a function phi of k? Well, Klaus has the answer, which is that, yes.
Maybe check if all the values of phi are taken or not or something.
Or what?
If all the values of phi are taken, because phi is periodic, it has a limited range. So.
But in principle, phi could go to 2 pi, or could go to 4 pi, or could go to 6 pi. Okay. So you can't necessarily do that. That's hard. But so in fact, the solution is that we integrate the derivative of the function phi of k. So if the derivative is always positive with some average slope, that will give you 2 pi. If the derivative sort of oscillates or something and it integrates to 0, then that means that you didn't go around. So this is going to equal 2 pi times the winding number. Okay, so I like to think of this as the, I don't know if people say this outside of the US, but there's a, you know, the classic joke that parents say, when I was your age, I had to walk uphill to school both ways through the snow. So this is how you can walk uphill both ways and get back to where you started.
Another question.
Yes.
Can we also just check the final value and divide it by 2 pi? Since we have the phase function explicitly.
Yeah, so in that case you can, but okay, so the reason why we write it this way is because sometimes you don't have the phase function explicitly. So yeah, that, yeah, you're right. In this case, it's not necessary, but okay, you may have access only to the function e to the i phi of k. In that case, you can't check the final value, right? But you can still check the derivative. Okay, so now I'm going to write this derivative in a way which is kind of unmotivated, but turns out to be nice, that So I kind of messed up the sign convention. So I should have had a minus sign there. So let me fix that. So if psi of k is equal to minus I phi of k, then del k phi is I times this. Good question?
Is this supposed to be like from a Clausius integral or?
So yes, more or less. But physicists are normally not careful about this. So the usual physicist rule is you pretend I is a symbol and then you do stuff and you hope it works. So that's the perspective I'm taking. But yes, technically it's a contour integral.
Okay.
So this thing here has a name. This is called the Berry connection. And then the integral from 0 to 2 pi of this has the name Berry phase. Okay, so that's just some terminology. But now,
Aaron, just to confirm here, the decay of phi is means when you write an inner product, it automatically has an integral, right? Or because we are writing our psi as our wave function. So the Berry connection has an integral already? I don't know.
No. So this is, I think I will come back to your question in just a minute because I'm going to say something else that I think will make this less confusing.
Okay.
Yeah, so I think this is confusing because this psi of k, as I've written it down, is nothing but a complex number. So it's kind of like, nothing's happening. So let me just finish this particular story, which is that what we found is that the Berry phase is 2 pi n. But we have the freedom to change phi of k to any continuous function with phi of 2 pi equals phi of 0 plus 2 pi n. That's just because it's a wave function, the overall sign doesn't matter. Implies that the Berry phase is not physical. Normally, we would say this way. That it's not gauge invariant, where the gauge is our choice of this phase for each function. Yes?
So, where do we have psi and phi right now? So, we changed in the integral, now one is psi and one is phi?
No, I just have bad handwriting.
Okay, and then we said if this x that you wrote e to the minus I phi of k, is that now still a phi or a psi?
This is a phi.
And in the
phi? This is a psi.
And only
then
we call it the Berry connection, or
Berry connection is the name of this particular quantity. It doesn't like the phi is actually irrelevant to that definition.
So nothing changed from the first to the second.
What changed? No. So the point of the second line was that I just messed up, and the conventional way of defining things is that this phase is e to the minus I phi, and I previously wrote e to the I phi, so I just wanted to fix that to get the right definition of the Berry connection. That's all.
So I just want to understand a little better. When you say connection, like what vector space is it? Can like could you talk more about like just like a connection? What is it connecting? The phase from 0 to 2 pi? Is that the
That is a good question. I don't know the answer. I don't really know the answer to that question.
I remember hearing at some point that there's some construction you can do where you basically attach, you know, like in GR, you attach your tangent bundle, then in Young-Wills, you attach some other vector bundle, and then here, you could attach a Hilbert space to, like, your manifold.
Yes, that's what this psi k is. So that's kind of what I was not talking about when I say that this CK dagger, that's your manifold is like K, and at each the Hilbert space that you add is the Hilbert space based on this CK, which is parameterized by psi K, the wave function at that point. This is the vector in that vector space at each point in your K manifold. Okay. I think that's the answer to your question, but
I just remember there was something really, really nice. I think even in the Gauss-Poisson theorem, but I have to look it up. But maybe look it up.
Okay.
Aaron, the last line of the left-hand side board, it says phi k equals phi. What is the last thing that we can replace?
Here.
Yeah.
That phi of 2 pi is equal to phi of 0 plus
okay.
7 2 pi.
Okay. Thanks.
Okay, so we can try again to get something that's topological and is, in fact, gauge invariant. That's a real physical thing. So what we're going to do is consider a case of two sites per unit cell. So here we have CAK dagger 0 times some coefficient A sub k plus the same thing on a second site. In this case, my wave function is in the form AK BK. So we can now fix a gauge. By choosing the first coefficient AK to be real and positive. Or I guess we can choose it could be zero. So we can't necessarily rule that out. But then in that case, this BK is equal to its norm times some phase, which will depend on K. And thus we can use this integral of dk phi dk to define some winding number. Question?
I think we're
okay.
The global phase doesn't matter, but the relative phase does.
Correct.
Okay.
But the point is that, so I mean, that's, you know, always true in quantum mechanics in general, but here we're saying that in particular, this relative phase can be used to define some topological number. Okay, so and then a brief remark here. If there are two bands, number is defined for each band. And the winding numbers that we get for the two bands from this calculation have to be equal and opposite to each other. I mean, in this case, you can see that just directly from the definition, because if one eigenstate is of the form this, then the other eigenstate would be that. And because of this minus sign, you're going to get this minus sign will end up producing the opposite winding number. Yes?
I have more than two bands, but I always get sum to zero.
Yes. But that's not obvious to prove, and I don't remember exactly how to prove it, so I'm not going to.
Can I repeat find the sum to zero in this case for two bands?
In this case, they do.
Yeah.
So I'm assuming this is one eigenstate, right? As a function of k, so then this must be the other eigenstate to be orthogonal. I should be more careful actually than what it said. So we can view this as e to the I
does it need to be sign
difference
on phases in each eigenstate?
Yeah, okay. Now I confused myself. So maybe I'll come back to this. Okay, I will come back to this. I've done something wrong. Okay, we'll come back to this. Okay, so I'm actually going to leave the 1D case here, because on your next homework, your next homework will pick up here, and there's a problem which illustrates this in a concrete case, and you can actually work out everything and compute everything. You'll see that there's indeed this topological number is robust and so forth. Okay, so we'll continue 1D case in the homework. So now let's look at what happens in two dimensions. So in two dimensions, we're now looking at maps. From our two-dimensional momentum to our, again, our eigenstates. Just like before, the energies don't do anything because maps from the space of two-dimensional momentum to the real numbers still are all equivalent. So this space of momentum is now the torus, which goes by the name T2. So I'm going to particularly consider the case like we did before, where we have two bands. So if we have two bands, we can always write our Hamiltonian in this form. I mean, this is a general form for any translation invariant Hamiltonian. But this H is a 2x2 Hermitian matrix. So basically, I'm choosing this case because 2x2 Hermitian matrices are very nice. And therefore, we can write H as you're same entertained.
You know, I just remember in one class, the radical physicist teaching the class said, now we'll put our model on a torus. And there was an experimentalist in the class, and he was just sitting there looking so confused. And he commented, in your lab, you don't need to actually put this thing on a torus.
Yeah, right. Well, it turns out that, you know, edges and surfaces are confusing, so toruses are nice. Okay, so we have this nice form for our HK. And the eigenvalues here are A plus or minus the magnitude of n. So as long as this n is bigger than 0 for every value of k, there's a band gap. And we can describe H by vector n hat. Which is some element of the sphere. And then, basically, this is so A only affects the energy and doesn't affect the eigenstates. Right. So, okay. So this is derived H this way. Okay. Well, and also by A, and that implies the eigenvectors, which are the topological thing. Are described by just the vector n hat. Since they don't depend on A, they also don't. OK, so H is described by the vector n and A. But then the eigenstates that you get don't depend on A. They also don't depend on the magnitude of n. Magnitude of n only affects the eigenvalues. So in other words, the space of eigenvectors is S2. Therefore, K mapping to eigenvectors is the map from T2 to S2.
There's something that I don't understand about this.
Yes.
You want to be able to describe the case in which the vector n goes to zero, right? How about the same?
So I want n to never go to zero.
Okay. Is it going to answer the other situation also?
So, okay. We'll get that's the very last thing I'm going to say is what happens when n goes to zero. Okay. Yes.
So just so I understand, in general, if we had like n bands, then we're mapping T dimensional space to some n dimensional space.
Yes. But yeah, so okay, I'm doing two bands because you know, it's like why you're putting things on a torus, because two bands is the case that I know how to give a nice physical picture. For higher numbers of bands, I don't actually know a like similarly nice picture.
But it's always going to be SN, for example.
No.
And the topology and structure of the target space is determined by the Hamiltonian, which, because that becomes eigenvectors.
Yes, okay. Yes, that's right. Okay, so we want to classify our maps now from torus to the sphere. This problem is like kind of not obvious. But it turns out the classification is the same as maps from S2 to S2. The intuition is that the only thing that's different about T2 versus S2 in the initial space is that T2 has some like non-contractible loops. But if you take those non-contractible loops and you move them onto the sphere in the target space, they can be contracted. So there's no difference in T2 and S2 in the starting space. That's a rough picture, not a proof. And I don't know how to actually prove this. So you have to take it, you know, on faith for now. But at least this classification from S2 to S2 is something that we can actually understand. So I claim that this is also going to be equal to integers. And the picture is something like this. So n equals, I'm going to explain this picture that I'm drawing. So the sphere is the K space. Well, not really case-based, because case-based is a torus, but this is like the case-based equivalent. This is the thing we're mapping from. And then the spin direction is the value in target space at each point. So this is n equals 0 because it's a constant map. Basically, every vector in the target space points in the same direction. N equals 1 is the case where every point on the sphere, your vector points in the direction of that point. N equals 2 is something that sort of like rotates like twice as fast. So n equals 2 looks something like this, where you rotate sort of your thing rotates all the way around by the time you get to the center, and then rotates around again at the bottom, and so forth. So this n, in this sort of picture where we talk about the spin configurations, also has the name of Skirmion number. You're talking about a spin model.
Aaron, how does this generalize? Means how, I don't see the pattern at n is equal to 3, how it will be?
So if you imagine that there's an angle theta, so like if n hat is equal to whatever, x component, y component, and then cosine theta, like spherical coordinates, then the the vector that's located n hat will look like something cosine of 3 theta for n equals 3, for example.
Okay.
So like it wrote as you go around the sphere, it rotates 3 times as fast.
Okay, I see.
Yeah, I mean it's not obvious. Like I sort of drew the n equals 2 picture because it's confusing. Also, n equals minus 1 is also confusing. So this is I'm not claiming this is easy to understand, but I think the n equals 1 case and n equals 0 case are easy to understand. And the rest are hard. That's my claim.
I thought Skirmion referred in general to a spin structure, but you're saying it's only for n equals
1? Oh, no. Like this n is called the Skirmion number. Yeah. Okay, so now let's suppose we have this classification. Now let's try to apply this to our actual situation. So for band structure, this n is called the Chern number. And it's computed in the following way. Turns out it's equal to this. And I'm not going to prove this formula, but so this can be computed for any band.
You're saying that every band has a fermion number, and that number is also called the Chern number in that band.
Yeah, well, so in this case, Chern number is the way you should think about it. There's like the skirmion number is like that term is usually only used in the context of spin configurations. I'm just pointing out that it happens to be the same thing as what we're here calling Chern number.
Okay, I see.
So Chern number is the correct name to use. In this case. So then a note like what we were talking about last time, that sum of an I over all bands will be equal to zero. That again is something I'm not going to prove, but that is true. And now finally, since we started a few minutes late, I'll go a few more minutes. So to finish up, I want to talk about the physical picture that we get. I'm going to consider just the 2D case and with two bands, just to make things concrete. So I suppose I have my case space, and I've got some lower band and an upper band. And what I'm plotting here is E of K. And let's suppose that this band has a Chern number of n, and this has a Chern number of minus n. And then I'm going to take another something over here, which has a Chern number of n and a Chern number of minus n for the lower band. And then I create some composite thing. Here's my material. If I tried to this is a confusing picture, but I'm going to draw the picture, then we can talk about what it means. So one thing I could try to do, so now I have my material here, which had upper band with Chern number minus n and lower band Chern number n. Same thing with n and minus n here. And I try to bring them together in such a way that we maintain the energy gap. I should say something else too. So this Chern number can also be rewritten in a different form. Like this. Yes, that's a curl. And this is a gauge invariant local quantity. Which is known as the Berry curvature.
In general, or just in 2D?
I'm going to say 2D for now, because you can define something similar in 3D, but the invariant looks quite different. So So for now, we'll say 2D. Yes, and this curl is defined, I mean, the way the curl is defined is by that, but it's basically the 3D curl, but you take the Z component off. Okay, so here, we could imagine deforming our band so that this very curvature is constant, right? So then, so N is equal to like 2 pi squared times the very curvature. And I bring these bands together, and here I have the Berry curvature is equal to n over 2 pi, or minus n over 2 pi, and here it's n over 2 pi, and here's this boundary, and this is bad because this is a topological quantity. It's not allowed to change smoothly. It has to change abruptly. It's quantized. And nevertheless, I'm claiming that there's one band which has a boundary where it suddenly jumps from one to the other. So that's a something happening non-continuous, which means that this picture is not allowed. So instead, what must happen is that when I bring these things together, I have my individual turn numbers. And then right at the boundary, we have to have an energy crossing that connects the N band with the N band and the minus N band with the minus N band.
Surface? Just this picture that you're drawing with crossing things.
Well, okay, so this is not on the surface, is that you're saying?
Yeah, or just reminding me of the picture of the K.
It is. That's exactly what this is. So the fact that this picture is not allowed means that if I bring something with turn numbers, with like one set of turn numbers for its bands, next to something with a different set of turn numbers for its bands, at the boundary, there has to be a zero energy. The energy has to go to zero.
And so but when we have the minus n and the n, is this also on the surface or in the bulk? Does that have anything to do with this? Or?
Okay, so we're talking about a 2D material, right?
Oh, true.
So this is the 2D bulk, and this is also the 2D bulk. And this is a one-dimensional surface state on the boundary between two two-dimensional materials. So like I have, let me draw it this way, that here I have turn numbers n and minus n, and here I have turn numbers minus n and n for the upper and lower bands. And so if I like draw my E of K, it has to look something like this. Okay, so this, I am definitely not claiming this is any kind of rigorous thing which you should like just believe. I haven't done anything like a proof. So I think part of why this is very confusing is because we're mixing a real space picture and a momentum space picture, right? So when I talk about each individual piece by itself, my picture is completely momentum space. This is a momentum space picture. My band, I'm drawing in momentum space, right? But here I'm talking about a localized surface state, which is in real space, right? I think that's the reason why this is confusing. So the picture that we want to have in mind, though, is that our material is very large. And if you have a large enough material, then like if we look at some local piece of it, it will act like you could do, it looks translation invariant within some local region. So we could basically define a local band structure. We can get like HK as a function of R. Do you see what I'm saying?
Can you just maybe explain in this picture what will the difference in the material be, if you can specify that, between a material on the left and on the right that has these swapped very turn numbers?
Okay, so yes, so okay, that's a good question, and so the answer is that generally speaking, you can't see. Well, okay, maybe sometimes you can, but in general, you might not be able to. That topologically distinct states may be locally indistinguishable. So, like, if I looked at this piece of material with the bands, turn numbers minus n and n, and this one with n and minus n, it could be these are the same material, and there's two different topological states, which are, like, if I did any local measurements here or local measurements here, I'd get the same thing either way. And it's only when I bring them together that I can tell that they weren't the same as each other. So, okay, I'm going to maybe say that when I put the post to homework 2 soon, on homework 2 there's a problem which is dealing with exactly this in a completely solvable case. And I'm not sure that will necessarily answer your conceptual questions, but you will at least see that this works out. So the thing we're going to look at actually is a one-dimensional chain which looks like this. So basically something we've already done, where we have two different hoppings, T1 and T2. But it turns out that if you put two T1 hoppings next to each other, like that, then at this point, you get a topological zero energy mode. And there's no difference between this side and this side, except that we shifted over a unit cell by 1.
And again, just referring to this, because if I have somehow I can picture it much more easily in 3 dimensions, that I have like an insulating bulk and like electricity can flow on the outside surface.
Yes.
Are we sitting here? Like, you know, it's 1D, but like, where's the line where it's flowing? Would that literally be the boundary?
Yes.
But,
I mean, okay, so you could get some something gapless here, but you can also get gapless modes around the boundaries here as well. I mean, like when you do the actual topological insulator experiment, you get the gapless state on the surface of your material, not just when you bring it next to some other piece, right? So there's some sort of secret rule that the vacuum has turn number 0. And therefore, anything with a non-zero turn number would have an edge state on the edge of itself, its own self, just by itself. This is not a statement which I find to be very obvious. I think that's a somewhat confusing statement. But again, maybe this question, this 1D problem, will help to clarify it a bit.